my friends. Welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. Joining us on the phone is Eric Margolis. He's an award-winning author, columnist, and broadcaster. He's covered 14 wars and is contributing foreign editor to the Toronto Sun. He's the author of the book War at the Top of the World, The Struggle for Afghanistan, Kashmir, and Tibet. Welcome to the show, sir.
Nice to be with you.
I want to start this interview by reading from an interview of you from the United Press International 1 week after the war began in 2003. It says, the United States will be bogged down in a protracted guerrilla war in Iraq even after Saddam Hussein is killed or captured, an analyst with 25 years experience in covering the Middle East predicted. Quote, I believe there will still be resistance, Eric Margolis, foreign affairs columnist for the Toronto Sun, said in a telephone interview. The Iraqis consider themselves the leaders of the Arab world. They're sending a message to the Arabs. There will be violence of some kind. Margolis drew a parallel with Afghanistan. There, he said, the United States has, quote, overthrown the government and put the Afghan communists back in power in the north. And it's got Hamid Karzai as a kind of puppet ruler in Kabul, protected by foreign troops. But the rest of the country is in chaos. And it goes on here, quoting you, sir, as basically predicting everything that's happened since then, which is a long-term guerrilla-style warfare, pinning our troops down in Iraq. And as we speak, the death toll of American soldiers in Iraq is now approaching 1,500 troops. It looks like you called it.
Well, I wish I was as accurate with my predictions on the stock market. unfortunately, my predictions on Iraq and Afghanistan have been borne out. They really weren't crystal ball predictions. What they were conclusions based on my long experience in the area. And a lot of time spent in Iraq and Afghanistan, it was very clear to me and to other veterans of that part of the world, as opposed to armchair strategists in Washington, that what was going to happen, and the outlook was not good.
And when you speak of your experience, it says in your biography that you've covered 14 wars around the world.
I have indeed, mainly in Asia, but a number in Africa and also Central America. I have been a war correspondent, and I write often on military affairs, which interests me. I was a former soldier in the U.S. Army and used to teach military strategy and history to field grade officers in the Army.
And despite writing for the Toronto Sun, you are an American, correct?
I'm an American. I'm a native-born New Yorker, very much so. I live in Canada for a variety of reasons. Well, I also have a home in Florida, so I'm sort of bi-national.
I see. Okay, well, I guess we can begin to get to the news here before the first break. And I think we really need to start with Syria here. I'm very interested to know what you think is going to happen in Lebanon. The Syrians have announced that they will begin to pull their troops out of Lebanon after the assassination of their former Prime Minister Hariri a week ago. Do you think that will help relieve some of the American pressure against Syria, or...?
Only a small amount, and I'm not entirely sure the Syrians are going to completely withdraw. It seems to me that the Bush administration has determined that it wants to overthrow the current government of Syria, run by Bashar Assad, who inherited it from his father, Hafez. And the Syrian government is isolated, it's almost friendless except for Iran. And Americans feel that overthrowing the Syrian regime, which is the other half of the Ba'ath Party that once ruled Iraq, too, that it will complete or it will greatly advance America's the role of dominating the Middle East, and it will also help break the Iraqi insurgency.
Okay, we'll be right back with Eric Margolis on the Weekend Interview Show. My friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton. We're talking with Eric Margolis. And thanks to antiwar.com, where I have a column posted up there today, I see breaking headline, Israel blames Syria for suicide bombing that took place in Tel Aviv last night. That's according to The Guardian. And it seems like the fact that Syria has never attacked us doesn't seem to dissuade our government from seeing them as our enemy. Is it simply because they are Israel's enemy?
That's right. The Bush administration has almost completely adopted Israel's view of events in the Middle East, rightly or wrongly, and made all of Israel's enemies, that's the various Palestinian groups, they've been proclaimed America's enemies as well and branded as terrorists. So, in fact, it led General Brent Scowcroft, who was the U.S. National Security Advisor under Bush's father, to say recently that Prime Minister Ariel Sharon of Israel had wrapped President Bush around his little finger, just underlining the fact that U.S. policy was really running parallel with Israel's.
And is this? Do you think this explains why our government tends to conflate every sort of different terrorist group, where Islamic Jihad is Hamas, is Hezbollah, is Al Qaeda?
That's
all just sort of a war against terror.
The administration gets a lot of its information about the Middle East from Israel or through Israeli-friendly sources in the United States, so it naturally tends to reflect the view. It's wrong to say the view of Israel. I should say the view of Israel's right wing, because there's another half of Israel which is quite against the current policies.
Is there any truth, do you think, to Donald Rumsfeld's assertions that Syria is in large part responsible for the insurgency in Iraq?
No, I think that's absolutely untrue. More nonsense. I have no doubt that Syria is probably quietly playing a very, very discreet role in helping some insurgent groups in Iraq, or sheltering some leading Iraqis. And the Syrians would be perfectly happy to see the U.S. defeated in Iraq. It's only natural. Iran is probably doing the same thing, but on a very low-key and minor scale. The real reason for the Iraqi insurgency lies with Iraqis themselves.
Well, and Syria has been trying to cooperate with us in the war on terrorism to a degree. I know that they torture people for us sometimes.
Yes, you're quite right. A very shameful part of our behavior these days. We ship suspects, I underline the word suspects, to Syria, but even more often to Egypt, where they're brutally tortured, also in Pakistan and American bases in Afghanistan. The Syrians have bent over backwards to accommodate the United States. They're very frightened that they're going to be overthrown, or they're going to be attacked from two sides, one by the Israelis, the other from the Americans in Iraq. So they're doing everything they can to make nice to Washington right now, and not to give the U.S. any pretext, or Israel for that matter, any pretext to attack them. And this assassination that we began discussing of former Prime Minister Rafik Hariri in Lebanon, everybody's blaming it on the Syrians, but in fact it's probably the worst possible thing that could have happened to the Syrians right now.
You've written of your suspicion that Israel murdered Yasser Arafat. Do you suspect Israel's hand in the bombing that killed Hariri?
I really don't know, and I think we'll probably never know. There have been 12 prominent Lebanese political personalities or warlords who've been assassinated over the last 20 years. None of these assassinations have been solved. So you can't blame it, lay the finger on anybody. However, the people who benefited from the Hariri assassinations were not the Syrians at all, but the Maronite Christian Lebanese, who are very anti-Syrian, and Israel, which has long been was waging a 20-year struggle with Syria to control Lebanon.
Well, and our government seemed to pick up the idea that Syria was responsible. I believe Condoleezza Rice pulled our envoy out of Lebanon, or out of Syria, and Bush made some pretty harsh public statements about what they better do and fast.
Oh, that's right. It was very undiplomatic behavior. But this administration is very low on the scale when it comes to diplomacy. Condoleezza Rice, the new Secretary of State, came out and all but threatened war against Syria when there was not a shred of proof yet come to light of Syrian involvement in the assassination. And even if there was, it may not be grounds for a war between the United States and Syria.
Yeah, do we have an official alliance with Lebanon?
No, we do not.
So who really cares? What does that have to do with the United States?
Well, exactly. But we were so involved, we've become so much part of that area's affairs and taken so much part the side of Israel in these current arguments, for better or for worse, that we naturally were drawn into everything that happens there.
Do you think that the administration is really looking to start further hostilities in that region? I mean, it seems like there's a lot of bluster and trial balloons and talk about airstrikes against Iran or toppling the government in Syria, but can the United States really handle that?
No. But what the administration is doing is huffing and puffing, big bad wolf style, as they did before invading Iraq. They're trying to provoke a coup d'etat in both Iran and Syria, an overthrow of the existing regime, regime change on the cheap. So far, it's not working, but it will not work in Iran, I don't think. But there might be a chance it could work in Syria, where the government is run by a minority religious sect called the Alawis, who are about 10% of the population of Syria. They're very unpopular, and the mainstream Sunnis, the majority there, would like to overthrow the government. So in a shaky position, pressure might provoke something in Syria, but what would come out of it is very hard to say.
Do you think that, you know, like the trial balloons that they've talked about, limited airstrikes by us or by Israel against nuclear facilities in Iran, do you think that that could be accomplished without the war immediately spreading? I mean, could they go in and do one night of bombing and then that and then end it? Or would it necessarily blow up the whole region?
It would be the U.S. and Israel have long been planning to bomb separately or together nuclear-associated strategic targets in Iran. The U.S. has supplied Israel with the aircraft to do so. But Iran's targets are, as we read, are heavily buried. They're buried inside tunnels in the mountains. They're not easy to knock out. It may not be able to destroy Iran's program with targeted strikes, and it may cause Iran to put the squeeze on United States troops in Iraq. Dangerous situation. As far as a ground invasion goes, a lot of Islamic, anti-American Islamic forces are praying that the United States will invade Iran, saying that the same thing will happen as happened to the Germans and Russia. Iran is so big, it's a 70 or 80 million people population, not a small country like Iraq. It will swallow up the U.S. Army, which is already stretched beyond thinness in Iraq. And really give the U.S. a defeat. I say I hope that the U.S. does not ever contemplate a ground invasion of Iran, or even Syria for that matter.
That seems to go along with what Michael Scheuer, the author of Imperial Hubris, says, that America has really been Laden's indispensable ally, that the radical insurgents all across that region that we're fighting with, that basically it seems every policy that the United States government takes only advances their agenda.
Well, Scheuer is absolutely right. His book, Imperial Hubris, I think is the best book that's been written on the area. He was one of the few people in Washington who actually, this is the chief CIA anti-terrorism analyst who followed bin Laden's career for many years, and he knew exactly what was going on. He understands the Middle East. I wish I had written his book. It's that good, and I recommend it to everyone to read. He was kicked out of the CIA for having written it. But the Scheuer is right, because, and he says the U.S. has been bin Laden's best ally, because bin Laden is saying what we want to do. He said we can't destroy the United States' power in the Middle East. He wants to kick the U.S. out of the Middle East. The only way to do it is to suck the U.S. into a lot of small, debilitating wars that will eventually bleed it till it's so weak that it will pull out of our region. That's bin Laden's strategy, and so far President Bush has stepped right into it, making bin Laden very happy.
Boy, and that's got to be something that's really hard for people to come to grips with, the idea that everything that perhaps they've supported for the last, say, 3.5 years in terms of American foreign policy has actually been playing directly into the hands of our enemy. And that George Bush isn't so much a great leader as he is an eighth grade boy stumbling into disaster after disaster.
Well,
I mean, if it was me, I'd have a hard time changing my mind, probably.
You know, unfortunately, patriotism and anger and an urge for revenge from 9/11 has clouded our the sense of judgment of many of us, and we're thinking with adrenaline rather than with logic in the Middle East. And I have seen the entire Muslim world turn violently against the United States, not just the Muslim world, the whole outside world. I spend a lot of my time traveling around the world. The entire world is angry at the United States, as I have never seen before in my 6 decades of life. It is appalling. We are generating enemies faster than we can count them, and I ascribe it to the ham-handed policy of the administration, which has struck out at almost at phantoms, and in the process trampled a lot of countries and peoples who are now furious at us.
According to Michael Scheuer, one of Osama bin Laden's complaints is the United States' support of India in its war against Muslim minorities there. And I know you've written a book about that war at the top of the world, about the conflict in Kashmir. So when we get back from that break, I want to ask you a little bit about that. It's a subject that I think everybody knows a tiny bit about, but not really very much detail. So when we get back, we'll talk about Kashmir. It's Eric Margolis on the Weekend Interview Show. My friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Scott Horton, and I'm talking with Eric Margolis. He's covered 14 wars, and he's the author of a book called War at the Top of the World. And that's what I wanted to ask you about right now, is a conflict over that disputed territory between India and Pakistan, Kashmir.
I wrote the book to try and raise American awareness of this issue, which is very little understood and even less looked at in the U.S., but is extremely dangerous. It's a dispute been going on since 1947, since India and Pakistan were created, over the mountainous territory of Kashmir, which is divided now between India and Pakistan. And over the last decade, there has been an increasingly violent uprising by Kashmir, which is mostly Muslim, but it has a Hindu majority. But the Kashmir's Muslims have risen up and started guerrilla warfare against Indian rule in the Indian portion of Kashmir. And about 10 to 14,000 people have been killed so far. Some sources say up to 60,000. It's a very dirty war marked by torture, reprisals, gang rapes, mass killings, assassinations going on as we speak. And the danger is that it has twice in recent years brought India and Pakistan to the brink of war. And both of these countries are nuclear armed powers. And as recently as 2 years ago, both of their nuclear forces went on alert. And we came the closest that the world has come to a nuclear war since the Cuban Missile Crisis.
And all this, what's so important about the land, Kashmir, that neither side is willing to give it up?
It's an emotional struggle. India and Pakistan, which used to be one nation, are like a divorced couple fighting over teacups. They hate each other so much, and they mistrust each other so much that they fight over everything. But Kashmir has a particular symbolic value because it's a majority Muslim state, and the Indians feel that if Kashmir were ever to gain independence from India, that the whole Indian Union might start to unravel, and it's a sense of national pride. The Indians are very prickly about this. For Pakistan, Kashmir is their fellow Muslims being tormented and tortured and oppressed by India, and it's their duty to reunite the Muslims of South Asia.
And now this has to do with us, or at least in my mind it comes up, because when reading Imperial Hubris, Mike Scheuer talks about some, I believe it was some Muslims, had killed 12 or 13 Hindus, and the Hindus fought back by massacring like 50,000 of the Muslims, and America said not a thing about it. And so Osama bin Laden used that as a public relations stunt to say, see, the Americans don't care when the cow worshippers massacre us by the tens of thousands of people. They don't care at all. They're just interested in Islamic people dying everywhere. And it was the biggest PR coup that he could have hoped for.
Well, that's right. You were referring to the massacres in Gujarat, which were one of these outbursts of senseless communal violence that came out of nowhere. And there were massacres of many thousands of Muslims there. And, yes, America shrugged it off because America, what happened, the Bush administration, immediately any enemy of Islamic groups is a friend of America's. And the administration has been positioning itself, purposely or by accident, I'm not sure which, almost against every Muslim group abroad, no matter what the justice or the injustice or the justice of its position. And by this I mean that there's some validity to the struggle for independence of Kashmiri Muslims. There is total validity to the struggle of Chechens for freedom from Russia. And yet we have branded the Kashmiri resistance forces and the Chechen resistance forces who are being massacred and tortured by the Russians as terrorists. And a lot of the world regards Hezbollah in Lebanon and some of the Palestinian groups as legitimate national liberation groups who are fighting injustice and oppression. But to Washington, it makes no distinction. And it reminds me of the same mistake that we made in the 1960s and 70s, where we branded every group that was opposing the status quo as pro-communist. Some of them were not. Some of them were. But the ones that were not were gradually pushed into the communist camp by our one-sided attitude.
So in the end, it's beginning to shape up like it's going to be the lifelong struggle that Dick Cheney has promised us. This doesn't seem to be winding down, only escalating.
No, and in fact, if you look around the world, you see the United States militarily involved or politically involved with intelligence forces against the Muslims of Kashmir, against Muslim separatists in the southern Philippines who have a very legitimate cause for grievances, against the Palestinians, against the people revolting against the military government in Algeria, an exceptionally brutal regime, and the Chechens that I mentioned. The only time the United States in recent years has come to the aid of Muslims and gained great favor in the Muslim world was when the U.S. intervened in the Balkans and saved the Muslims and Catholics of Albania from ethnic cleansing and potential genocide by the Serbs. This was done by President Clinton.
Interestingly, doesn't it seem as though a lot of the neoconservatives have such a distaste for Russia that they would rather beat the Russians over the head with the Chechens rather than kind of lump the Chechens in with the rest of the terrorists?
Their views are very confused on that. You know, it was the neoconservatives in Washington who helped the Russians get back into Afghanistan.
Right. All right. I'm sorry, Mr. Margolis. We got to go out to break here. We'll be right back, everybody. It's Eric Margolis on the Weekend Interview Show.
Don't take your guns to town.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network because you can handle the truth.
My friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Eric Margolis. He's covered 14 wars, and he's written a book called War at the Top of the World. My website, weekendinterviewshow.com, for the archives in MP3 format of any of the previous interviews. And everybody, please go and read the article I wrote that's up today on antiwar.com called Man, Technology, and State. Okay, now, Mr. Margolis, in the years, I guess, between Republicans there, while Bill Clinton was running this country, there was a lot of media about the idea of convergence with the Soviet Union. As they become more and more like us, and as we become more and more like them, that basically there can be this great alliance of the North, and that perhaps NATO could even stretch all the way from Alaska all the way around to Alaska again. And yet, since the Bush, and I never liked this, by the way, I was always very suspicious of this policy, only now with the Bush administration and the neoconservatives in power, it seems like they're really trying to pick a fight with Russia every chance they get, and even using Russia's Islamic extremists as a bludgeon to beat them over the head with. What's going on here?
I think the Bush administration it can't decide what it wants to do with Russia. On one hand, it wants Russia as an ally against Islamic enemies of the United States, and Russia is very useful in that because it has great influence through Central Asia and still some in the Mideast. There's also American business which wants to take a bigger role in Russia. On the other hand, there's concern in the administration. I think it's legitimate concern that Russia, you know, is still on its knees after the collapse of the Soviet Union. But under Putin, it's struggling up. And as soon as Russia gets strong again, Russia is going to become a very, very dangerous rival again of the United States. The interests of Russia and the United States are clashing head on. And the United States is pushing its influence through NATO closer and closer to Russia's borders. And we're mucking around now in the Caucasus, which is Russia's backyard, and certainly in Central Asia, where we have military bases. Russians are very nervous about this. They don't quite know what to do because they need our money and our friendship right now to rebuild their strength, but they're extremely worried. So it's a very difficult question about how to handle Russia.
Well, it seems like, I mean, obviously it's just in sheer size and natural resources. It's a tremendously wealthy country. And as you say, clearly assuming they're at a state of peace for long periods of time will be an incredibly strong rival. But in my mind, it seems like that would be a good reason to be nice and make friends rather than poking them in the chest all the time, and which could, you know, very well lead to the same situation we had for 50 years there of Cold War.
Well, I agree with you entirely. The Russians are a very proud and capable people. The country, as you say, is extremely rich. It's got enormous oil reserves. And the Russians are, you can't keep them down for very long. The two biggest questions confronting American foreign policy in the next decade are going to be how to deal with Russia and manage its resurgence as an important power, and how to deal with the growth of Chinese and Indian power. These are the big questions. And I don't believe in the giddy liberalism of some of the Clinton people, peace and harmony stretching, across the continent. But I don't agree in the dangers, the reckless aggressiveness of some of Bush's right-wing people either. The Europeans, I think, have the right approach to Russia, the European Union. They're cautious, but they're engaging Russia on many different levels, economic, political, military, and they're trying to convince Russia that there is no danger to the Russians, who are always paranoid about their neighbors, and to manage the process of Russia's rebuilding.
Well, what do you think about the American intervention, at least financially, in the election, and then I guess they canceled that election, and then the second election of Yushchenko in the Ukraine. How do you think that the Russians perceived our intervention there?
From the Russian point of view, it's all a CIA-managed plot to overthrow Russian influence and pro-Russian figures in those regions under the guise of bringing democracy and freedom. Those are buzzwords.
Inaccurate, their view?
Well, no, not entirely inaccurate. That's the problem. There is truth to that, but there's also truth to the fact that we in the United States have done a very positive thing by helping these countries stage free elections and opening up information flow and educating people. It's very hard to say where proper, legitimate, democratic instruction stops and political agitation and subversion begins. You know, it's like with missionaries. When do they stop helping people and start giving them religious instruction?
Right. Well, you know, but you just have to think back a couple of years to 1996 and Chinese funding of Bill Clinton's reelection in this country. And, even the Democrats thought that was criminal, some of them anyway. Is that different somehow? Americans financing one side or another?
Well, no. You know, influencing foreign elections through money is time honored. And whatever the Chinese did was small potatoes compared to what the United States has done ever since World War II. I mean, we used to finance Italy's ruling party, the Christian Democrats, for years, and the Christian Democrats in Germany were sustained financially by the United States for many years. So we're the grand masters at buying influence around the world. The Russians, unfortunately, they never had enough money to be really big time in this area.
Is it your experience that everyone on Earth knows that this is how America operates, except Americans?
Except Americans.
Because I'm trying to put myself in the position of someone whose, I don't know, their family was killed by a fascist dictator installed by the United States, sitting back listening to a lecture about democracy and human rights.
Well, it galls a lot of people abroad. I tell you what really galls me is to hear the administration lecturing about freedom and democracy and human rights, and yet, let's just focus on the Middle East and preaching that we've got to have democracy and freedom in the Middle East. Well, America's closest Mideastern ally is Egypt. Egypt contains almost 33% of all the Arabs. And yet Egypt is run by a military dictatorship, by the Egyptian army. It tortures people. It's a very repressive dictatorship. And if the U.S. wanted to start bringing democracy to the Middle East, it could start in the countries that it controls: Egypt, Jordan, Morocco, Tunisia, whose leader just won an election with 98% of the vote. Now our best friend Libya, same thing, and so on down the Gulf, and of course Saudi Arabia, and our allies in Central Asia, like Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan, who are some of the most beastly dictatorships you can find anywhere on Earth today.
So why don't we encourage them to be democratic?
Because, for two reasons. A, because the present regime is useful to the United States for a variety of reasons. Do we go back to the old thing we did in Latin America and Central America in previous decades? And secondly, because in a lot of these places, if they held an election, forces not friendly to the United States would emerge victorious. So I'll give you there was one free election only in the Middle East, one really legitimate, free, open election. I discount Iraq. And that was in Algeria in 1991. And what happened? The military dictatorship allowed a free parliamentary vote, and Islamic parties won. And immediately the military, on orders in agreement with Washington and Paris, annulled the elections, jailed all the opposition leaders, and has had to clamp the military dictatorship ever since.
Do you think that anybody in the administration really believes in all this exporting democracy, or is this simply just public relations to cover for naked imperial aggression?
I think the cynics understand that this is all just window dressing for an aggressive sort of imperial foreign policy. But it scares me to think that there might actually be people who believe this kind of stuff, because if they
that would be worse.
They're even more dangerous, and in my mind, they're just as bad as the communists who believed in the international destiny of communism. You know, I spent a lot of time in the Soviet Union, and I'm really dismayed when our government is sounding increasingly more and more like the old Soviet Union of Brezhnev, who used to preach the internationalist duty of the Soviet Union to liberate oppressed peoples around the world.
Yeah, see, we're becoming more and more like them every day. I don't know why we can't just be friends.
Well, they're becoming more like we used to be, and we're becoming it is very ironic.
Oh, my goodness. All right, let's switch gears back to the goings-on in Israel and so forth. Now, they've been working on this peace plan, the roadmap to peace, and they keep having these meetings where everybody shakes hands, and it seems like everybody's getting along, but then there's another terrorist attack, and the circle of reprisal starts again. So I wonder whether you think that this roadmap is actually going to lead to any sort of peaceful solution, or is it capable of leading to any sort of real peaceful solution over the long term there?
Well, as I say, in the Middle East, pessimism springs eternal. I hope so. I hope there will be peace, but the road still looks to me like a dead end for the following reason. Israel's current government, led by the right-wing Likud party, which is so close to the Bush administration, you can't tell where one ends and one continues, really wants to hold on to the majority of the West Bank and the Golan and Syria's former Golan Heights, and to expand Jewish settlements and to make a really strong Israel to dominate the central Middle East. Sharon's view, as he's expressed recently, or what he sees as a Palestinian entity, they don't even call it a state, is a group of three or four little isolated cantons that are cut off one from the other by Jewish-only security roads, as they're called, surrounded by Israeli troops on this big wall, and cut off from contacts with the outside world. No roads, sea, or air links, no direct telecommunication links, no banking links. So it's really what critics are calling it, reminiscent of South Africa's Bantustan, sort of tribal reservations. If this is the case, there will never be a deal with the Palestinians. Violence will continue. It's only when the Palestinians see that they're going to get something that looks like a contiguous, viable, semi-independent state on the West Bank and Gaza that I think there's going to be a hope for peace.
So you don't even think it would necessarily have to be the entire West Bank and Gaza, but maybe just a piece of it as long as you can get from one spot to another within it.
Well, the problem there is, you know, the land is sold by teaspoonfuls. There's so little of it. The Israelis have grabbed most of the arable land and the best water resources and the militarily useful high ground in the area. And the Palestinians say, listen, we've given up most of Palestine, as mandated by the UN originally, and we're not going to give up anymore. And besides, we have 3 or 4 million Palestinians who are living in exile. They have a right to come home. And the Israelis are saying, no, there's no right of return for any of these Palestinians who lost their homes in 1947 and 48, even though we have room to bring in Russians and other people from abroad to settle in Israel. And that's the problem.
Yeah, that's an interesting double standard. If your great-grandfather to the 15th power was exiled from Israel back in biblical times, you have the right of return. But if your family was kicked out in the 40s, forget it.
Well, that's the problem. And the Israelis reply, well, listen, you know, a lot of Jews who lived in the Arab world were thrown out or fled or left in the 1940s and 50s, and they deserve compensation. I agree, they do. I think everyone deserves compensation on both sides. I think Israel's center-left government had the right answers for solving this problem. This is the tragedy. And it wanted to make a token resettlement of Arab refugees inside Israel. It wanted to share Jerusalem. And it wanted to create a viable, decent state for the Palestinians. Israel's right wing, which was supported by the Bush administration totally, has completely precluded this kind of reasonable settlement and doesn't want a settlement because they have, they've got really what they want, which is the West Bank and the water and the land, and they feel that, you know, why should they make a deal where they have to give things up? How does it benefit them? It doesn't.
Yeah, well, except for their kids not being blown up at the local pizza parlor, maybe.
Well, exactly. That is, of course, you identify the problem.
Huh. Well, and, you know, it's interesting, too, because when you talk of, well, you know, in the public policy debate about the Middle East always talks about the Israelis and the Palestinians, but what we're really talking about is individual human beings here who have property rights, who are born free, and it's not really okay to violate a settler's property rights on the West Bank, a Jewish settler, any more than it is okay for that settler to violate the property rights of a Palestinian who lives there, right?
Well, I studied international law and I refer to it on occasion, and the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza and the Golan Heights is illegal under international law, and it's considered such by the European Union. The United States used to consider it illegal, but now it's changed its opinion. It's not right for that to continue if the Israelis, as you just said, want to make a permanent peace settlement. And half of Israelis think that the settlements should end. I mean, this is not a universalist thought that they must settle. But nothing is going to happen there to push these parties to peace unless the United States intervenes actively and energetically as an honest broker between the party and pushes both into a peace agreement. And right now, the Bush administration is so aligned with the Sharon government in Israel that it has no desire and certainly no capability of fulfilling this role.
All right. Well, let's see. We're about to go out to break here. When we get back, I want to ask you about what you think about the Iraqi elections. Scott Ritter said last week that the poll numbers were faked by the United States. And I wonder if you were surprised that the United Iraqi Alliance got only 48% of the vote. When
that's very curious, isn't it? More grist for the mill of cynics.
Yes, well, we definitely have plenty of it over there.
Do you want to talk about that now? Or
yeah, well, no, let's go ahead and wait. We'll come back to that after the break. I just thought, you know, one thing that got me that you said earlier about a good reason that our government thinks it has to topple the government in Syria is to break the back of the insurgency, I think is the words you use. And I was just thinking how I thought the back of the insurgency was broken last fall when we reinvaded Fallujah and reduced it to rubble.
Good point. Well, remember, we invaded Cambodia and Laos for the same reasons that we were going to crush the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese by getting at their base camp.
Oh, right. And the war only lasted 8 years after that, right?
That's right. Didn't work so well.
All right, everybody. I'm Scott Horton. It's the Weekend Interview Show. We're talking with Eric Margolis from the Toronto Sun. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. All right, my friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. Wrapping up with Eric Margolis. He's a columnist for the Toronto Sun and is the author of the book War at the Top of the World, The Struggle for Afghanistan, Kashmir, and Tibet. And I think we need to spend this last little segment here, sir, getting back to the subject of the occupation of Iraq. Before the break, I mentioned that Scott Ritter gave a speech and said that he has it from secret sources inside the government that America faked the election results and that the United Iraqi Alliance actually scored 65-something percent of the vote, which was later falsely reduced by the Americans to 48%. What do you think of that?
I have great respect for Scott Ritter. I really don't know what the answer is, but for the people who faked the U.S. into war in Iraq, it would not surprise me. I hope it's not true. The elections don't mean very much for a couple of reasons. First of all, under international law, an election held under foreign military occupation is not a legal election. When the Soviets invaded Hungary and Czechoslovakia, they held elections afterwards, and we in America called these elections bogus and the people who were elected stooges. Secondly, what kind of government is this? It's a window dressing government. The United States controls all the military and police forces in Iraq. It controls the oil production and the revenue from oil production, which is the sole source of money. It has U.S. advisors control every Iraqi government ministry and its foreign affairs. And everything that happens in Iraq is controlled by the U.S. embassy in Baghdad, and the U.S. forces provide the protection for this. So what does the government run? Dog catching, street cleaning, secondary schools, fine. But it's not a real government. And I hope a real government will grow out of this election, though I don't think the U.S. will allow the Shiites ever to gain complete power. You'll know it's truly becoming an independent government when the Iraqi government tells the U.S. to get out and to hand back the oil revenues.
Well, according to Hillary Clinton, that might be 50 years from now.
Well, I'm afraid so, because we are...
And by the way, I should say, she wasn't being negative when she said that. She was, you know, hey, we might be there for 50 years. What the hey, we're still in Japan and Germany. Who cares, right? That's
no, she might even... She might like it, but we're building 8 very large military bases in Iraq, which has the Middle East's second largest oil reserves. My view is that we intend to stay in Iraq and to dominate Iraq and to make sure, as the British did before us, that we will keep friendly governments in power there that will, by whatever it takes, that will pump cheap oil keep American bases there and do pretty much what they're told. This is what happens across the rest of the Middle East. I don't see why any change is going to happen now.
Mr. Margolis, Osama bin Laden and his guys cannot defeat the United States. We have a $10 trillion economy. We have two oceans and two friendly neighbors, an armed population, a couple of mountain ranges thrown in. This country can never be defeated by the likes of him. But I wonder if you think we could ever defeat them.
I think eventually we could defeat an Islamic insurgency against us. They surely can't defeat us, but they can make our lives so miserable that we eventually get out of the Middle East, which is Osama's objective.
And mine too. What a coincidence.
We can go on killing their leadership and perhaps suppress this insurgency. It's not a terrorist movement. It's an insurgency, as Michael Scheuer says. But it's going to take us a long time, and really the price is not worth it. We're spending too much money on this operation. We can't afford to keep up this level of operations indefinitely. It is going to bankrupt us in the long run.
This has been absolutely great. Thank you so much for coming on the show today, Mr. Margolis.
You're very welcome. It's been a pleasure.
Everybody, Eric Margolis, he writes for the Toronto Sun. It's a weekend interview show. The website's weekendinterviewshow.com, and we'll talk with you next week.